And welcome back to a brand new episode of MTG Eternities. I'm your host, Carl. And I'd like to apologize ahead of time. I'm sorry this episode's a bit later than I would have liked. I was dealing with a fair amount of issues this week, the biggest of which is my dog passed away, so I've had a rather difficult time trying to record this. But that being said, go ahead and quickly move on from that. I don't want to linger too much on that. A lot happened this week, both in the world of Magic and when it came to my personal career. In Magic, I went to a local PPTQ. Didn't do that well. Ended up with a losing record. I dropped out of the event. My mind wasn't in that great of a place. I probably shouldn't have gone in to begin with, but I thought something like that could cheer me up. But I won't linger too much on that. If I remember it, the top deck of the day was a Mono Black Zombies deck, followed by a Marvel deck. Those ended up taking the local PPTQ. One of which, the local Marvel deck, I believe took second place, was a good friend of mine ended up taking that second spot. His name's Mac, and hopefully I'll have him on here as another guest later in the coming weeks when we get closer to release and stuff like that. But we do have other topics to touch on, and I'm not going to linger too much on the PPTQ. Earlier today, I honestly thought it was just somebody initially just flaking out fake cards again. But to my surprise, it was confirmed by Wizards. We do have three new cards previewed for Hours of Devastation. I do think on Wizards' part, it is a massive leak. It kind of killed a little bit of the hype for Hour of Devastation for me already. Seeing probably both Planeswalkers out of the set, there more than likely won't be a third. If there is, it'll be something low-key we won't expect. So I'm going to go over those quickly here. If you haven't seen them, you maybe want to skip ahead 5-10 minutes or so. But this is a spoiler alert if you don't like spoilers. The first card I want to talk about is Bantu's Last Reckoning. 1 colorless, 2 black, sorcery speed. Destroy all creatures and lands you control don't untap during your next untap step. So for 3 mana, you get to wipe the board, and then you're kind of stuck next turn having your lands not being able to do anything. Yeah, you get to lay down another land. You might be able to do like a Magma Spray or a Fatal Push or something like that next turn, try to keep the board clear. What I find curious about this card is, for the longest time, Wizards has kind of refused to print a good Wrath spell. We've been stuck at the 5-drop Wrath spell spot, where it's either bad or it's just kind of slow. I think the best 5-drop Wrath spell in recent history is probably Fumigate. It's not the best, but it serves its purpose correctly. The last 4-drop Wrath spells I could remember are Supreme Verdict and Day of Judgment. Both those were from the previous Ravnica block, or both those were in Standard during the previous Ravnica block. And that's kind of where Wizards stopped the 4-drop Wrath spells. We've had things like Yhini's Expertise, Languish, Mutilate, stuff like that to kind of pseudo-wrath the board or keep the board state down, but we haven't had an effective Wrath spell in the longest time, at the 4-drop slot at least. So now we have one at the 3-drop slot with a severe drawback. Things that come to mind, I am going to dig a little bit into the past on this one. When it comes to 3-drop Wrath spells, 2 3-drop Wrath spells that stick out to me are Legacy and EDH, really. The first one is Harsh Mercy, which is 2 colorless, 1 white. You and each player at the table effectively chooses a creature type, and everything that's not that creature type just gets destroyed off the field and can't be regenerated for 3. So you see that card in EDH, you see it in tribal decks that can play white, so Slivers, Kithkins, Humans, anything that could fit white in their deck usually plays that if it's tribal. And then the other 3-drop Wrath spell that you see play in Legacy and in EDH, and on occasion I think Vintage has even tried it, but Toxic Deluge, 2 colorless, 1 black. In addition, you lose X life, and all creatures on the field get -X/-X for the turn. And so it actually gets rid of indestructibility as well, and it'll go around regeneration and stuff. The only way to really stop that is to return it back to your hand or just kill your opponent after they've wiped the field with burn or something like that. So we've had 3-drop Wrath spells in the past, like Harsh Mercy and Toxic Deluge. But this is a first, as far as I can remember, in Standard where we have a 3-drop Wrath spell. We've had Anger of the Gods, we've had Sweltering Suns, we've had other cards like that, where at turn 3 it'll do 3 damage to the field, or turn 4, in recent history at least, it'll do -4/-4 to all the field. But we haven't had an effective Wrath spell, where it just outright destroys everything at the 4-drop or less spot. So for Standard right now, where I think we're going to be looking at this, is yes, it's going to be a control shell for sure, and it's probably going to be a limited bomb. I think in Limited, that card's going to do fairly well. As of where it would see play in Standard, Zombies doesn't want to play this thing. It's not going to fit well in their Grixis. It might fit into the Grixis shell should one arise. The problem with the Grixis shell is it's too black and a colorless. So you got to look at what other decks right now are playing black. You could potentially put that into a Marvel shell, oddly enough. Like, Marvel needs more answers. But Marvel generally doesn't use the land base to cast the things it needs. It uses Aetherworks Marvel to do it. So you could put that into a Marvel shell rather than, say, Sweltering Suns or something. Destroy all the field. Yeah, some of your lands don't tap. But then you play cards like Aether Hub and stuff like that to gain you energy, and you'll just revamp the Aetherworks Marvel for a turn. Does it necessarily mean that Aetherworks Marvel will include black? No. It's just me spitballing ideas of where this card might go into. Mardu Vehicles might be able to play this card as well, considering that they utilize Vehicles as their main win condition, and they also utilize Gideon. So it might be something that they slam down on the field turn 5 after they've laid their Gideon and their Vehicle just to secure the field a little bit more. Then you're left dealing with a Vehicle like Articron or something like that, and you're left dealing with Gideon. And that's probably going to put you on a bit of a backswing, unfortunately. There are other places to play this card. Right now, I would love to see the rest of the Hour's Devastation set slowly leaked over time, but at the same time, I mentioned earlier that these leaks kind of killed the process for me a little bit. I love seeing spoilers, and to see some of these three cards in particular spoiled earlier has kind of killed Hour's Devastation just a little bit for me when it comes to spoiler season. We do have other things to work with, and it's a matter of seeing the rest of the set released. I do think that Bantu's Last Reckoning will be worth playing in Standard. I don't think it necessarily has a place in Modern yet, but we'll wait and see. So the other two cards that were spoiled today were, as far as I know, both Planeswalkers for Hour of Devastation. The first one I'm going to go over really quickly is Samut the Tested. We had Samut as a creature card in the previous set, and now she's a Planeswalker. They've only done this, to my knowledge, one other time, where it started the exact opposite way, where we had Xenagos as a Planeswalker, and then he turned into a legendary god. So it's kind of like the reverse situation of this. Ironically enough, yes, they both do share the green-red colors, so I don't know if that's how they plan to attempt to do green-red in the future, because they're waiting to find a decent red-green Planeswalker so far. But when it comes to red-green Planeswalkers, I think they've missed the mark on a lot of them. And unfortunately, I think Samut is another missed mark. Xenagos, when he was in Standard and he was a red-green Planeswalker, I do think they hit him pretty well, and so far he's been the best red-green Planeswalker in my opinion. Just as when it comes to monocolors, Koth, I think, is still the best red Planeswalker. They have done Chandra recently, and Chandra Torch of the Finest is starting to pick up steam, and I'm looking forward to seeing her a little bit more Modern, but I'll get to that another time. But going back to Samut really quickly, her plus one is up to one target creature gains double strike. A lot of people are complaining about this ability right now, and I'm on the fence myself. So the way I look at it is in Sealed, she's going to be pretty decent. But when it comes to the pre-release for Hours of Devastation, I actually want her in my two-headed giant pool. The reason being, I looked at the ability and it doesn't say a creature you control. So if your opponent doesn't have a lot and your other head for two-headed giant has something, you can go plus one, target the other head's creature, and the other head's creature can swing over with flying or trample with double strike, which to me is just really good, at least in that scenario. I do think she has limited potential when it comes to that particular ability, but her other two abilities kind of seem more EDH-focused and Standard-focused a little bit. So her minus two, I think, is the Standard-focused one, where you deal two damage divided as you choose among up to one or two target creatures and or players. So her minus two is a fork bolt. I think that's kind of weak for a Planeswalker. Granted, at some point in the story, she literally just ignites her spark, so she's still getting used to her Planeswalking abilities. So it makes sense to have a fairly weak burn spell as her minus two lore-wise, I think. But to me, it's just not that fitting. There's not a lot that you're going to end up two-for-one-ing, at least. When it comes to one-drops, I think the standard one-drop right now is Thraven Inspector, and that's a 1-2. So if you minus two, you're just going to kill a Thraven Inspector. It's not going to hit any vehicles. Sure, you could burn an opponent for two, but there aren't a lot of direct burn spells outside of Shock right now in Standard that are seeing a lot of play. So her minus two to me isn't really that great. And her minus seven it's absolutely insane, her minus 7 for EDH purposes. And if we get a control deck at some point in Standard that utilizes green and red, yeah, then maybe her minus 7 will be good there too. But her minus 7 is also lore-wise, I think... This is just me spitballing. I think Semut's going to go over to Nicobolas and try to kill him or something like that, and she's going to summon two of the Gatewatch to her side, probably like Gideon and Chandra or something. Whoever she summons is probably going to get killed. Knock on wood, it's not one of your favorite Planeswalkers, folks. But that's what her minus 7 is to me, is at least lore-wise. But looking at her minus 7, it's search your library for up to two Planeswalkers and or creatures and put them onto the battlefield and shuffle your library. So with her minus 7 in EDH, if you have a doubling season out, you could automatically alter. Search your deck for two more Planeswalkers or search your deck for two really important creatures. Put them onto the battlefield. Doubling season triggers, you can activate those, or the creatures will just be there on the field and just do amazing things for you. It might be another way to run an Emrakul deck in Modern, just putting Emrakul out onto the field. Unfortunately, it is a little slow, especially for Modern. I'm on the fence about Semut the Tested, just as I'm on the fence about Bantu's Last Reckoning. It's an odd situation for me. Semut doesn't necessarily feel good, and I'm looking for places for her right now. Maybe red-green monsters, since it's starting to reemerge again in Standard. Even with Jun, maybe they'll try to fit her in, but I think it's going to be hard-pressed to find a proper spot. I will mention really quickly that Semut the Tested is a 4-drop boar loyalty planeswalker, which we've kind of come to expect. She's not below average, thankfully. I think the worst 4-drop planeswalker that we saw was original Nissa at a 4-drop 2 loyalty. 4-drop 3 loyalty, 4-drop 4 loyalty has kind of become the standard at this point. And I'm okay with her being 4 loyalty. Thankfully, it doesn't take a lot to get her to where she needs to go. But at the same time, there aren't a lot of great planeswalkers in her colors. In red, yeah, you get Chandra Torch of Defiance, or you get Chandra Flamecaller from Zendikar, which isn't too bad. They're both great planeswalkers. In green, you have two different versions of Nissa you can call. You don't even have to get same colors as her. It's just beneficial. Let's say you stick a Jace for whatever reason in your deck, and you draw him. You're not going to have a way to cast him. It's even hard-pressed to say that if you put her in a Jun build that you can get out one of the two Lilianas, which is fine. Getting more walkers on the field is great. In Standard, it's pretty busted. But it's just one of those situations where, yeah, I have more walkers, but now I'm going to have to tick those up to get their alts off as well. So for Standard purposes, she doesn't seem to fit as well to me. So maybe her place is actually in EDH, or maybe her place is in Limited. That would be my assumption for right now. Just looking at her first two abilities, I don't think her alt is definitely what you shouldn't be looking at. You shouldn't ever be looking at alts for Standard. You should just be using their base abilities. And her base abilities, at least to me, scream limited play in Standard, amazing play in limited formats like Sealed, Two-Headed Giant, Draft. I do want to get on to the third and final card that was spoiled today, and that is Nicobolas, God Pharaoh. He is a 7-costing planeswalker, 4 colorless, 1 blue, 1 black, 1 red. So yes, everyone is very excited that he remained his Grixis colors, and maybe he is the sign that Grixis will be a thing. But once we see more of the set release, I think we'll know for sure. But like I was saying, he is a 7-drop planeswalker with 7 loyalty on him. His +2 is target opponent exiles cards from the top of their library until they exile a non-land card. Until end of turn, you may cast this card without paying its mana cost. So right then and there, that's insane to me. If somehow you manage to get rid of all the non-land cards in your opponent's deck, if for some reason they decide to do that in Standard somehow, that's potentially a win con. You're able to exile your opponent's deck. But that's just way the heck out there. That's far left field. What realistically this is amazing for, you just slam this guy down, +2, your opponent exiles all the cards, and then for whatever reason they reveal an Ulamog off the top of their deck or a Torrential Gearhulk off the top of their deck. And now you get to play an Ulamog or Torrential Gearhulk or other value cards that you potentially could need. It is a punt depending on what kind of deck you're playing against. Like against zombies, that kind of ability wouldn't necessarily be great, but against Marvel, against Mardu, against any sort of control matchup, that particular ability will do fairly well, I think. His +1 is each opponent exiles 2 cards from their hand. which is another great ability. The key word there in that ability is each. So clearly that ability, even though it's for standard play, it's going to hurt most in limited when in two-headed giant matchups, and it's going to hurt most in EDH when your ability is going to affect everyone on the field, not just one person. The more value you can get out from him, the better. And it's just one of those abilities where the more people you're playing against, the better that ability just keeps getting. Because you're forcing each and every opponent to make sudden decisions where they had now had to exile two things from their hand. They could be two lands, but if they're down to two cards and both cards are value, like going back to my previous example, Ulamog and Torrential Gearhulk, if they for whatever reason have both those in hand, and you plus one, now they don't have anything. You just got rid of roughly $40-$50 in value just from one ability off one card, which is amazing. His third ability is a minus four. It deals damage to target creature an opponent controls or a player. Now, it is fantastic that since I'm starting out with seven loyalty, I can go plus one, exile the top card, cast it, potentially get myself a blocker, and then in two turns, you're going to take 14 to the dome. That's almost guaranteed game at that point. Or if you're running the card from Aether Revolt, Dark Intimidations, the Grixis colors, two colorless, one blue, one black, one red, each opponent sacrifices a creature or a planeswalker, then discards a card. You get to return a creature or planeswalker card from your graveyard and draw a card. When you cast a Bolas planeswalker spell, exile Dark Intimidations from your grave, that planeswalker enters the battlefield with an additional loyalty counter on it. So the reason I bring up that card in particular, especially when talking about his minus 4 ability, is that's going to bring him up to 8 loyalty automatically. So one, that's going to make his alt, which we'll get to, cheaper if you want to go the alt route. Or it's going to make him able to go minus 4, deal 7 damage to the dome. You protect him for a turn, and then you go minus 4, deal 14 damage to the dome. And if 14 damage doesn't kill your opponent for whatever reason, it's darn sure going to put them into the point which where one swing from just about anything you control at that point will potentially kill them. You can always also just lay down another Nicol Bolas at that time after you kill that one off and just go minus 7, deal 21, and win the game with that method. So finally, his alt, which honestly I'm a little surprised by. It's kind of reminiscent of a few cards we've had in the past. But his alt is minus 12, exile all non-land permanents your opponent's control. I like this alt overall. The most similar card I can think of is Perilous Vault. Perilous Vault, for those who don't know, was a card from M15, 4-drop artifact. Pay 5 of any color, tap it, exile Perilous Vault, exile all non-land permanents. So it's a very similar ability to that. The major difference between the two, obviously, is Perilous Vault exiles everything on the field. Nicol Bolas is only going to exile stuff your opponents control. So that's going to mean all enchantments they control, all artifacts they control, creatures, so on and so forth. It's going to leave your board state completely alone. So in Standard, if you get to that point, you've definitely won the game. Same thing could be said for Modern, EDH, Legacy, any sort of format where you get to go, I'm going to exile the entire field and potentially restart the game and leave myself alone. You've effectively won, in my opinion, when it comes to that. Now, is his alt Standard playable? Absolutely. Will his alt happen a lot in Standard? I don't think it's going to happen a lot in Standard where you're what you're going to see is you're going to see a minus 4 a lot, and you're going to see a plus 2 a lot. I think the other abilities are more along the lines meant for EDH, because why exile the entire field when I can go minus 4, hit my opponent for 7, minus 2, get something of theirs, put it on the field. Nicol Bolas is still alive? Okay, minus 4 again, hit my opponent for 7, swing with the thing that I just stole from them, and potentially win game. That's just my idea on it. There might be others. But I don't think, in Standard at least, you'll see a lot of minus 12 exile everything. I could be wrong, I've been proven wrong in the past, but that's just my opinion on it. Now, I did mention that spoiler season is kind of killed for me right now. I don't know if a lot of people are out there are feeling this, but I kind of feel like it has been killed, because normally we like to see Planeswalkers. We have a whole set to look forward to in Hour of Devastation, but we don't. More than likely, we don't have any walkers to look forward to. More than likely, now that Nicol Bolas has been spoiled, a lot of people were looking forward to seeing him when they were wanting to see him. They were wanting to get hyped. And now I think that hype has been kind of killed. To an extent. The hype has been killed to an extent, and it has been killed for me at least. I mentioned I don't know if anyone out there is kind of feeling the way I feel about it. I definitely would like to hear everyone's thoughts on it, whether or not this leak was a good thing or a bad thing. Definitely leave them in your comments down below. Maybe we share the same idea. On to our next subject, we do have three major modern tournaments happen. We had Grand Prix Copenhagen, we had the Star City Classic at Baltimore, and we also had Grand Prix Kobe, all of which took place the same day. There wasn't a lot of coverage when it came to Kobe. The others were streamed a little bit. I unfortunately did not get to see any of them this weekend. I had issues to deal with. I mentioned them before, but I did get to look at the list, so I'm going to give you a little bit of my thoughts on everything, my opinions, and we'll go from there and see how things go. I want to start with Grand Prix Copenhagen. There was a top eight. At Grand Prix Copenhagen, the top eight were Death Shadow, Living End, Lantern Control, Is It Storm, a Creature Toolbox deck, another Death Shadow, Dredge, and Volokut, or you might know the name by Titan Shift. Those eight decks, it's great to see a wide variety of what's come up. In Copenhagen, I was fairly surprised that Creature Toolbox deck had made it. A lot of those have been starting to pop up a little bit more now, and I'm getting excited. I do think that Infect had something to do with keeping those down, and now that Infect's not seeing a lot more play, we are seeing a lot more of these top 8 toolbox decks starting to pop up, which is great for the format, I think. A few decks that I want to touch base with, the first of which is Living End. With Living End, it's starting to get a little bit more power, a little bit more steam, the reason being we did see a lot more Psycho cards printed in Standard. So you have cards like Horror of the Broken Land being played as a 4 of. When it hits on the field, it's a 4-4 for 5, and whenever you cycle, it gets +2/+1 for the turn. So the goal is to get a few of those in grave, you play Living End, and all your creatures come back, and then maybe you still have some cycle cards in your hand, so you can just cycle, power them up, and swing. I do think it's a great finisher for Living End. Another card that I am a little bit surprised to see as much modern play as it is seeing right now is Lost Legacy. You'd think because of its limitations, not being able to get an artifact, that it wouldn't see as much play. Plus, your opponent gets to draw if X cards are in their hand. Let's say you go ahead and say Lightning Bolt and they have three in hand. For whatever reason, they get to draw three cards. Like I said, I am kind of surprised to see that seeing as much modern play as it is right now. But things are changing. Times are changing. Affinity's kind of losing steam. It's not taking top as much. But you do have decks like Lantern Control seeing play a bit more. You have Death Shadow seeing play more. You have Dredge seeing play more. And to me, it's just one of those situations where Lost Legacy it's getting more and more pickable. Moving on to the Creature Toolbox deck that took top. There we also see a lot of cards from Amonkhet. There was a pretty funny combo. I don't know if anyone got to see the list, but I thought it was really funny. The Devoted Druid with Vizier of Remedies. So Devoted Druid is a 2-2 for 2. When it comes into play, you can tap it and produce one green. You put a -1/-1 counter on it, and then you can untap it and do it again. So Vizier Remedies effectively reads whenever something would get a -1/-1 counter on it, instead it gets one less. So since the Druid specifically reads it only gets one -1/-1 counter whenever you untap it, having that on the field would effectively produce infinite mana, let's say a billion mana for green. So if you have Cord of Calling in your hand, you're able to cord for anything you want in your deck. Or if you have Collected Company in your hand, which is what the two cards are that this deck runs, you're able to Collected Company effectively for free and just keep doing what it is you want to do until you get the right answers for it. If you have a Sack Engine, you can put Kitchen Finks on the field and gain a lot of life, gain a billion life. There's other things you can do. But those are just some things that come to mind. The Creature Toolbox is also playing Ronas the Indomitable from Amonkhet. I believe that particular deck played it as one of, but there might have been other Creature Toolboxes that played it as more. And the reason that card's seeing play is because it is hittable with Coco, and it is a 5-5 with Death Touch that's able to power up everything that you want and give it +2/+0 and trample. So if I have Devoted Druid Vizier Remedies on the field, and then I Coco into Ronas, well, guess what? I'm now going to pump up X creature multiple times with that +2/+0 that Ronas gives, and then just swing for a lot of damage. I keep saying a billion, and I just like a billion because it's a nice rounded number to me. We do see in that Creature Toolbox deck that took top, we saw Anafenza, which used to be a 3 of, 4 of main in these sorts of decks, is now getting moved to side. So the deck's kind of picking up and taking different things in its place. I believe it played none main and only one Anafenza side. It didn't even play a full set. It is another way to trigger and get rid of -1/-1 counters should all your viziers die, which is a great alternate, I think. But there are other options. And the biggest thing to me, was, and maybe this might be a surprise to you, but in this top 8 deck, normally Morelia, Silva, Outcast gets to see play, and the reason that saw play mainly was because Infect was a thing. But it also said effectively that you couldn't get -1/-1 counters. Well, now that Vizier Remedies is effectively an uncommon version of that card, and it's not legendary, we start to see Morelia not in the deck at all, or taken out completely when it comes to sideboard even. There's no real reason to play Morelia right now. Maybe when we go back to Phyrexia, or maybe if the Phyrexians go to different parts of the multiverse and we see Infect play, get a few more cards, maybe there'll be a reason to pick her up again and her in the deck. As for right now, there's no real reason, especially since she's legendary and you can only have one of her out on the field at any given time. So my suggestion would probably be to definitely, if you like the style deck, definitely start to look into it. The pieces are rather cheap when it's compared to a lot of modern decks. And definitely pick up Vizier of Remedies if you get a chance. That card seems pretty bonkers right now. The last deck I want to look at from Copenhagen is Dredge. Dredge seems to be making a comeback, and I'll touch back on this when it happens again. But Dredge took a top 8 seat at all 3 tournaments this weekend, which is fairly impressive for a deck that's no longer supposed to exist without Golgari Grave Troll. But Golgari Grave Troll has effectively been replaced by Golgari Thug. It's not the best replacement in the world there, but it's the best replacement that Golgari can get, because Dredge is a mechanic I don't think we'll ever see printed again, just like Affinity itself. I don't think Affinity is ever going to get reprinted again as an ability, and I don't think Dredge will either. But I could be proven wrong. Maybe Mark Rosewater has something up his sleeve. But Dredge is making a solid comeback despite the banning of Golgari Grave Troll. The 4 of Golgari Grave Troll was replaced for a 2 of Golgari Thug or 3 of Golgari Thug, and the 4th spot for another Life of the Loam, so now they're playing 3 or 4 of Life of the Loam main. We're also seeing a replacement of Scourge Devil in some of the decks, and the card they're replacing that with is actually Rally of the Peasants. So Rally of the Peasants is an instant 3 drop. All creatures you control get +2/+0, and then it has flashback for 2 colorless and a red. And its initial cost is also 2 colorless and a white, so it fits within the deck fairly well. If you're able to cast it, hard cast it, you can, and you could also bring it back from the graveyard. And the main reason that's seeing play over Scourge Devil is Scourge Devil, although it is another body on the field, it costs less to cast from the hand than Scourge Devil does, and it gets more of a buff than Scourge Devil does. I would definitely, if you're playing Dredge, look into the card, maybe give it playtesting. It seems fairly solid to me, and especially if you can somehow fit a white in there with a Shockland or something like that. All you need is one in case you have to cast it from hand. Otherwise, you could just pitch it from the grave and give all your stuff +2/+0, which still isn't bad to me. Brings us to our next big tournament, which was the Star City Classic at Baltimore. And there, for whatever reason, I think it's due to points or something, I wasn't 100% sure, but we have, instead of a top 8, we have a top 9. So, in order, from 1 to 9, we have a Jeskai control deck taking the day, then below that, another 4-color control deck, Affinity, red deck wins, Death Shadow, Living End again, another red deck wins, Izzet Storm, and a Volokut deck. Now, the interesting thing to this one to me is the fact that 2 control decks took first and second place. I couldn't imagine how big of a pain that must have been playing another control deck in top. If you know anything when it comes to standard and you see 2 Izzet control decks playing against each other, it usually ends up coming down whoever takes game 1. And I imagine it was something similar to this when it came to that situation. It's never good when you have 2 control decks playing each other. The games are going to be long and drawn out, and it's going to become a war of counters or whoever can land their threat first without having to worry about it resolving or something like that. Even though I didn't see the match, I feel like this one was fairly similar. Jeskai control deck, from the list that I looked at, it seemed to be a burn list. It brought back a Johnny Vengeance, Secure the Waste for late game, Elspeth Sun Champion, stuff like that. And it did play a 4 of Snapcaster as well. So flashback the burn and deal damage to face or get back things that are needed. Whereas the other 4 color control deck from the list, it seemed like it played as a toolbox using Gifts Ungiven. It was able to get whatever it needed out of the deck. It ran 2 Johnnies and a Hyrian sideboard. The downside of which, though, is, and I think the main reason why the Jeskai more than likely won over the 4 color control deck was it just came down to threats and fixing, per se. with Jeskai, you don't have to worry about four colors or five colors. And the four color deck, you have to make sure that you hit everything. If you miss one color, then that could throw your whole thing off. And I didn't see the match, but to me, that's just, it seems to happen a lot in Standard. And it might not happen as much in Modern, but I'm sure there are people out there who've had issues like that, where they're running a four-color control deck, or they're running a Jeskai deck, or they're running an Abzan deck, and they hit two out of their three colors, or three out of their four colors, and for whatever reason, they can't hit their fourth. But that's just my thought on it. It might have been something else that it came down to. I've never been a huge fan of control when it comes to playing it. I am playing one now in Standard, and it's just something you have to get used to. But when you're watching the games over somebody's shoulder or on Twitch or on stream when it comes to like big events when they stream it on the TVs or something like that, you just get used to seeing certain things. And to me, the four-color control deck, although it was great, was more suited for killing stuff. It didn't have a lot of counters compared to the Jeskai deck. The Jeskai deck also had a lot more burn when it came to being able to deal direct damage, and it was running one Ajani Vengeant main. So if the Ajani Vengeant main stuck at any point and the other deck didn't have a way to deal with it, which judging from the list, I think there was like one Cryptic Command in the four color deck main, and that was, if the Ajani hit, that was the only way to deal with it, main at least. So then the Ajani Vengeant's gonna control the match, the tap down colors that the four color control deck needs and keep them locked, and then eventually Lightning Helix to the face and get there for game beforehand. I don't think that the Ajani should have ulted at any point in the game, but should it have, that also would decide the victor in a four-color control matchup. If four-color control loses all of its colors, or any deck loses all of its colors, and has no way to recover quickly on that, then that's almost an auto-scoop for just about any deck. Moving on to two other decks that caught my attention for the Star City Classic at Baltimore, two red decks ended up topping. One of which had a Harsh Mentor, the other one did not. The one that did not ended up taking a slightly higher place than the one that had a Harsh Mentor main, which I thought was fairly impressive. Not impressive that the Harsh Mentor didn't take a higher placing, but impressive that two red deck wins ended up taking top eight. That alone by itself, we haven't seen red deck as we know it get into a top eight in a while. We've seen Skred and we've seen different variants, but we haven't seen two red decks, in at least in my knowledge, for a little while, take a top tournament. And they both ran a similar list. It's mono red. They're both burn decks using Boros Charms, Lightning Bolt, stuff like that. The main difference was one deck had a Harsh Mentor, the other did not. And sideboard. One deck had Dragon Claw, the other one had Core Firewalker. Granted, Core Firewalker is amazing in a burn matchup, but if you don't have your double white to cast the Core Firewalker, it's going to sit there in your hand. Or if your opponent's able to land out a Dragon Claw and you didn't bring in artifact removal like you should have, then that Dragon Claw is just going to sit there and do a lot more work than the Core Firewalker is going to do. I don't know if the two red decks played against each other. I don't know ultimately which would have taken it if they did, but my money is on the deck, and the original deck that took fourth place. That one had two Dragon's Claws. It had a bit more to deal with things. I love Core Firewalker, but if I had my choice over Dragon Claw or Core Firewalker, I'm taking Dragon Claw. Finally, I would like to mention briefly again Living End. Living End did have, instead of just Horror of the Broken Land in this particular variant, it was running Desert Corridon, I think is the name of the card. It's a cycle card for one red, draw a card, and then it eventually becomes a 6-4. It's just a big beefy beat stick. It was also running Kari Zev's Expertise. Now, all the Expertises are able to cast things for free effectively. So it's a way to get things out of your hand that you don't need, but a lot of people forget that you can cast suspend spells with the Expertises, which is really a reason why I like the one of Kari Zev's Expertise in this particular deck, because you go Kari Zev's Expertise, I'm going to take your one creature, we're going to Living End, yeah, the board's wiped, but now all my stuff's going to come back. I still have mana to do whatever I need to, so I can start cycling or I can do other things. It's also just a way to steal your opponent's one blocker or one big idiot that's doing stuff for them. You to play another cycle card or something else if you need to, and then swing for game. I really enjoy the card. I think it has a lot of potential in modern. There's one guy at my local shop who's actually collecting them and making a small investment out of them. So I can't wait to see more with the card in modern. I think it's made a small niche for itself, and I'm looking forward to seeing it pick itself up a little bit more. Finally, that does bring us to Grand Prix Kobe in Japan. Now, I know for sure that there was a lot of issues with this particular event. Not because there was major controversy or stuff, but because that there was a lot of stuff that was used outside of the norm. So before we get to that, I'm going to go over the top 8 real quick. Top 8 in order from 1 to 8, we have an Eldrazi aggro deck, a dredge deck, Death Shadow, Eldrazi Tron, Ad Nauseam, Affinity, and finally an Esper control followed by a Jeskai control. So with the Eldrazi aggro, I think is the first big controversy when it comes to things. So the Eldrazi aggro deck was supposed to, initially how it's built is it's run like Death and Taxes. Put stuff like Thalia in there, you put other Hate Bear cards, and then you have Eldrazi for late game. This instead had no Thalias, it had no other traditional control pieces out in Death and Taxes outside of Tide Hollow Scholar main. It ran it as a 4 of, if I remember correctly. The deck also ran no Cavernous Souls to protect itself late game. Grand normal Death and Taxes doesn't do that either, but considering how streamlined the deck was to exclusively Eldrazi, 4 Tide Hollow Scholars, and I think 1 Shriek Maw main, you probably could have been able to fit some Cavernous Souls in there as a 2 of or a 3 of to help with the control matchup, but at the same time, this deck took first place, so obviously this person knows what they're doing, they know their meta, and they took first place for the day. Whether or not it's a matter of catching people on their toes, or they knew what was going to go on initially, it's up for debate, but that was the first big one out of this particular tournament. The next big what-the-heck moment, at least to me, was with Affinity. So right now in Modern, I'm playing Affinity. I have Affinity built, I'm just checking things. I keep switching things up every now and then, but I think I'm a fairly solid Affinity player, or at least I would consider myself to be. This Affinity player ended up having the traditional Affinity build minus a few things. They didn't play more than 2 Steel Overseers in the deck. Now, if you play Affinity, Steel Overseer is a 3 of minimum most of the time. The card's just really good. It helps you get rid of a lot of stuff. It helps pump your creatures. It helps make Artbound Ravager an even bigger threat than it already is. The other thing with it is they also increased Edge Champion to a 3 of. Most decks run that as a 2 of, and 2 Masters or 3 Masters, 1, something like that. This person ended up taking Edge Champion as a 3 of, and then 2 of Master of Aetherium. So you might be wondering what they decided to do over Steel Overseer. The first card is a Welding Jar, or at least what I imagine to be taking that spot. And it's not a bad spot taker. I like Welding Jar in the main as a 1 of if you need it. The other card, and that this is the biggest one to me, is they decided to split their Galvanic Blast and their Thought Cast. They ran it as a 2 of a piece, so 2 Galvanic Blast, 2 Thought Cast. And then the last instant, normally that's it when it comes to instants in Affinity, but the last instant they decide to run in the deck is Collective Company. As an Affinity player, I think Collective Company is cute. I don't think it's going to be successful. With Affinity, there are a lot of things that Collective Company you can hit, but there's a very select few things you actually want to hit. So you want to hit threats. You hit Edge Champion, you hit Master, you hit Artbound. Everything else with Affinity is kind of lackluster, in my opinion. You hit Memnite or you hit Ornithopter, then it's super bad. You hit a couple of Signal Pests, that's not great. You hit a couple of Vault Scourges, that's not great either compared to the other threats in the deck. Collected Company does also not hit Cranioplating, it doesn't hit Mox, it doesn't hit Springleaf, so you're left with it hitting, in my opinion, to from what I've seen. I playtested the deck on Tapped Out, I just built it really quick and gave it a few shuffles. With Collected Company, it seems to hit good things every once in a while, but it doesn't hit multiple threats most of the time. It usually hits one threat and then a lackluster, or 2 lacklusters and no threat. I don't know what this Affinity player was thinking, putting the Collected Company in the deck. I'm not going to complain. It worked for them. It worked for that particular meta. I personally wouldn't do it. For whatever reason, they also decided to run a Snow-Covered Island. I think that one was just flavor because they like Snow-Covered Islands. They ran a Seagate Wreckage and Inventor's Fair. Inventor's Fair usually sees exclusive play in Lantern Control. Same thing with Seagate Wreckage. I don't know why they decided to run those there. The Inventor's Fair gains you life and allows you to search for an artifact. That one's fine. And Seagate Records allows you to draw a card late game if you're shy on cards, which if you play Affinity and you have a hand at some point, that means you didn't go and lay out all your cards turn one and turn two, so it was probably a slow start. So Seagate Records, I guess, helps keep with the momentum, helps keep your momentum up, which is fine. It just throws me off looking at the list as a whole. I don't think there was anything I found issue with their sideboard-wise, but I personally wouldn't do Collected Company. I know why they ran it. They probably thought they were going to see a lot of Anger of the Gods, a lot of Sweltering Suns or something like that. And it helps against that particular situation. But it's just not a situation where I want to do this as a one of. Not to mention, this was the only Collected Company in the deck that the person ran. It throws the deck off for me. It really does. It makes itself a 4-drop in the deck, and I don't want to draw a 4-drop. All my stuff, I want to be 3-drop or less, or I want threats. And the Collected Company could have been another Galvanic Blast, or the Collected Company could have been, if you wanted to, another Master of Aetherium if you really wanted more threats, or another Etch Champion, something. And to me, it just doesn't work. That's just my opinion on it. I'm going to leave it at there. My opinion means nothing right now because this person made a top 8 with the card. So it works in that particular situation. The last two things I want to touch on when it came to Grand Prix Kobe are an Esper build and Jeskai build for the control, so the 7th and 8th spots respectively. So with the Esper build, we have Glorybound Initiate, which was surprising to me. I don't know why that card was in there. I know removal is never an answer when it comes to Magic, but Glorybound Initiate dies to just about everything except an Ornithopter and a Signal Pest when it comes to Modern, and maybe a Noble Hierarch and a bird. Those are the only four cards that I can think don't kill it outright. And that's just creatures. There's Lightning Bolt, there's Hero's Downfall, there's any number of burn spells, there's Path to Exile. It just doesn't seem like a good card Modern, yet it made it into a top 8 as a 4 of nonetheless. I don't know how much work it did. I wasn't able to catch any streams, if there were. From what I heard, there wasn't any streams of Grand Prix Kobe. It throws things off for me. It's not the best thing, in my opinion. There probably could have been better things, but this ended up working for that person. Whereas the Jeskai control build, it was mostly burn, using Snapcasters and other burn cards. I think there were like 4 counters in the deck. I think there were like 4 of Logic Knot and 4 of Cryptic Command. And with Snapcasters, it's great to delve away some of the bad cards that you don't want, but at some point he probably delved away too many burn spells. And if you get rid of too many threats in the grave for Snapcaster to flashback, Snapcaster ends up being lackluster. And Spell Queller, I also think it's a great card. It's very Modern playable, but it also ends up being kind of, not lackluster, that's not the right word, but it ends up being kind of odd to me. I don't think that's necessarily where he wants to fit in a Jeskai burn deck, at least. If it was an Esper Flash deck, I could understand. I think that's more fitting for Spell Queller, but maybe that's just me. I'm sure everyone has their own thoughts on it, and everyone I've asked so far has said Grand Prix Kobe can kind of be ignored. When it comes to overseas things in Japan for card tournaments, I have a lot of people saying you could ignore that. They're anomalies. And I don't like to ignore things like that per se. I like to talk about them. They raise questions. They cause cards to spike briefly before people think, oh, this isn't going to work in a normal meta situation. And they did bring 4 regular deck strategies to Grand Prix Kobe. You had 4 regular decks with Death Shadow, Eldrazi, Tron, Ad Nauseam, and Dredge. All 4 of those decks had traditional deck lists. The only differences, obviously, were Eldrazi aggro, the affinity list, and the 2 control lists with Esper and Jeskai. I'm sure everyone has their own thoughts on Grand Prix Kobe, and these are just some of mine. That being said, this podcast definitely went on a lot longer than I thought it would. There was a lot that happened this weekend, and we were able to put a thoughtful discussion into it. I know we didn't probably touch base with everything, so I would like to hear everyone's comments in the section down below. Let me know what your thoughts are on Grand Prix Kobe, on Grand Prix Baltimore, on Grand Prix Copenhagen. Let me know what you think of the spoilers. Let me know how you might do at your next Grand Prix. What are you playing right now in Standard? What are your ideas on Modern? Now that we're in the midst of things and things are starting to pick up and Standard's getting interesting again, Modern's being tossed back into the spotlight, we're at a point of which where everything's starting to pick up speed a little bit more and a little bit more. It's only a matter of time before we're in the full swing of things when it comes to midsummer, late August, when we'll really start to see a lot more interesting things come along. Not to mention, we do have Grand Prix Vegas happening in a couple of weeks. Let me know if you guys plan on going. I think Grand Prix Vegas is going to be fun for a lot of people. I've always gone, and so far I have yet to miss out on Grand Prix Vegas. It's a super fun time. I hope you guys get to go. That being said, all lines of thought are open for all magic seekers. This is your host from MTG Eternities, signing out.